Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 17, delivered on April 3, 2017. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. Now, I've talked about risk and return on a number of occasions, culminating in the greater the risk, the greater the return, but it's not quite that simple. It's the greater the risk, the greater the expected return, but that's not the entire story. And I'm going to fill in a little more of the story today in this first pass at risk and return. This, by the way, is chapter 11. We don't do chapters 9 and 10 in the book. So, and I'm running parallel to the book, but I'm also giving you a little bit more information, information that is not in the book itself. But this is very much what the book is teaching as well. And I am having a hard time. Let's try this. Oh, good. Okay. Now, if you'll bear with me, I want to bring up... as far as risk goes, there are a number of ways that we can describe risk. Now, some of them are more formal ways, and some of them are less formal ways, more informal. But at the heart of risk is the idea of uncertainty. Risk means uncertainty. Bear with me one moment here. I'm going to try to do something to show you a couple of ideas about risk here. Seriously, okay. Wanted to show you a couple of pictures here. But let me start out with this. Practically speaking, you will probably live another 80 years about, okay? But I don't know that. You could die tomorrow. Hell, you could die tonight. But you'll probably die tomorrow. Or you could die in the 20... You realize you guys are probably going to live to the 22nd century? That's actually kind of creepy. It's going to be a really bad world. Anyway, no, it'll be a wonderful, wonderful place. You, madam, will probably live longer than he will. But I don't know that for sure. You could kick the bucket in 2 weeks, but you probably won't. You see, risk is uncertainty. I don't know for sure. Now, uncertainty comes from a number of different places. There is an uncertainty that is just pure, we don't know. If we had more information, we might know. But it might be the case that to get that information would require so much effort that it's better to bear the risk. The cost of bearing the risk is actually lower than the cost of learning how to avoid the risk. Sometimes we will take risks early on that we learn how not to take later on. For example, cars these days are extraordinarily safe compared to cars from other eras. And that's simply because we know more about it now than we did before. You are a maniac. You are young. You don't know enough not to drive like a blind trout. You don't know enough not to take something because someone says it will make you feel good. You don't, actually, you look like you're not the kind of guy that's like that. But we know that when people are young, they will take more risks just because they don't know. They don't even know how to frame the question, and only over time can they even frame the question of how do I avoid this risk or why should I avoid this risk? It takes a long time. Some people never figure out why they shouldn't drink too much. The hangover doesn't convince them that because their head is over here on the floor, they probably drank too much last night. But you see, for the most part, we do figure out over time, and we do lower our risks that way. But here's the thing. Okay. Metrics of risk. In other words, ways we measure risk. First, in the business world, the practical, the most commonly used identifier, marker, measurement of risk is interest rates. A lower risk company will have a lower coupon on its bonds than a higher risk company. A person getting a credit card will pay a higher rate on that credit card than he or she will on a car loan, because the car loan is less risk because there is an asset backing it. Interest rates are essentially the one that we use for measuring how to discount cash flows. If cash flows are very risky, we use a high discount rate. If cash flows are fairly certain that we're going to get them, then we use a lower rate for them. But interest rates are in business about the most common way to do risk. Now, getting a little beyond that, down into the core of business, one that is quite popular is the standard deviation. The standard deviation. And you probably saw this in your class, finance class, or rather in your stats class. And I'll do it again in this class, and we'll try to do it with calculators so that we don't, the potential to make one little mistake in a long chain calculation is just really high with these. Excel's great for getting rid of that too. But I do want to warn something. But first of all, before I talk about, go on. Standard deviation actually by itself is not the best one. There's one that's actually a little better. But I'll get to that in a second. Let me show you. Standard deviation just merely shows you the dispersal of returns. If we got a normal distribution and another normal distribution, the standard deviation measures, as we used to say in when I was teaching stats years ago, the splatter, how widely outcomes can spread around. You see, actuarially, it's fairly certain that your life will be within a fairly narrow band. Your life expectancy will be. Especially in a developed country, we know that you're not going to have a very high chance of dying at a young age. But other things are a little bit less certain. Now, if it is a normal distribution, if it's a normal distribution, and that assumption is way overused, but there you go, it's the way we do it. From the mean plus or minus one standard deviation, we can expect about 67% of the outcomes to lie. This is probability theory. This is not business. This is not economics. This is not accounting or finance. This is just probability theory. 67% of outcomes in a normal distribution will be between plus one and minus one standard deviation. I'm going to put this into practice here in a minute. However, plus or minus two standard deviations, about 95%. Of your outcomes will lie. You got more certainty because you got a wider set of possibilities. And then the mean plus or minus 3 standard deviations, about 99% of your outcomes will lie. Now, I got one to show you here that's actually real. It's my own, about how this is used in business. Every year, I have a certain average. I add up my sales, and over a period of years, the last 4 years, there's been pretty much a stable revenue. I'm a little worried about this year because I saw the first two shows have shown economic weakness. It's really giving me the creeps, but I'm going to assume that it's like it has been the last 4 years. Over the past 4 years, in my own company, where I create and then sell landscape photographic art, the average of my revenues, and this is not exactly it, but I'm using round numbers, was 20 grand average. Now, the standard deviation, I actually had to do this calculation twice in Excel. I deleted it and did it again just to make sure. It was almost exactly $4,500. I mean, it was within a couple of pennies the standard deviation was of $4,500. I thought, that's really weird to have such a perfect round number. Now, the mean wasn't exactly 20,000, but I'm just doing that to show you. Now, I'm going to have to get equipment, and I really should get this equipment here at the beginning of the year. But I need to be 95% sure that I can cover what will be about, what I need is about 11 grand after this equipment is spent. And this isn't accounting because on the tax forms, I got to depreciate it over 3 years and all that kind of crap. I'm talking about actual cash flow out of my pocket is going to be about 4 grand, and I want to make sure that I'm 95% sure that after that's over, I've got about 11 grand left in free cash flow. Okay, so what I can do here is I can say, well, I am 67% sure that I will be between $15,500 and $24,500. And here's the one that's important to me. I'm 95% sure that I'll be between $11,000 and $29,000. Just barely, it looks like I can justify on a 95% confidence level, spending the money for the new equipment now. This is practical business. This is what a lot of businesses do. We want to, usually the 95% is our marker. Can I be 95% sure that I will have a certain amount of money after some big expense or whatever it is? And yeah, it looks like in this case I will be just barely okay. But that's the practical use of standard deviations. However, the problem with the standard deviation is that it is dependent upon the scale of operations. A standard deviation of $4,500 is, for my company, is not the same as a standard deviation of $4,500 for a large corporation. They are just, the scale of operations is different. So the next one that is very important for businesses, and if you're in a business, you would probably see this one, is the coefficient of variation, the CV. And I've asked students over the years if this is emphasized, this coefficient, the CV, is emphasized in their stats classes. And I've gotten all over the board, yeah, no, I can't remember, I was stoned, you know, things like that. So, but if you want to apply it right here, the CV for my company for the last year, the CV is actually a percentage. It comes out as a percentage, which is kind of cool. And independent of the scale of the operation of the company. So, in other words, you can compare giant and small corporations by their CVs, and there's no, it's exactly the same metric. Give me a second here, I'm going to pull my calculator out. Did someone delete my calculator? Oh, there it is. Okay. And it's 4,500 divided by 20,000. And it's a 22.5% coefficient of variation. And it is a percentage. Yeah. Well, okay, let me point out something that I think what you're saying, doesn't the standard deviation already have the mean in it? Exactly. That's what's weird about it, though, is because it still is scaled to the operation size, so that those means that are being subtracted as you do the data point minus mean squared plus the data point minus mean squared, they're still building, accumulating these large numbers because of the size of the mean in them. The mean is larger for one of my competitors that's on a national scale. Their mean would be like $500,000. So they'd be taking individual data points, which would already be large for revenue for the year, minus large means, and then squaring those. You get some pretty big numbers pretty quickly in those. But your point is well taken. Her question is this. Look, standard deviations, don't they actually, the formula, which I was going to show you next time, but I'll write it here this time, is the square root of the sum, 1 over n minus 1 times the sum from I equals 1 to n of x sub i's minus the mean quantity squared. Boy, that's cool. You ought to get that a tat. You got to get that as a tat, seriously. You know, left shoulder, pull that up. Okay, maybe not. Okay. Anyway, but the mean is right there. But it's still, it's accumulating at this rapid rate because of the squaring phenomenon. And so when we divide out that mean at the bottom, it takes it out of the picture. It actually takes the mean out of the picture. So that it doesn't matter if it's a giant, large corporation. I'd really love to get my hands on the data for some of my competitors who are national, just to see what my CV is compared to theirs, but I'd have to hack their computers, and I'm just getting tired of doing that kind of stuff. Anyway. Okay. Now. And then comes the measure of risk that I've talked about before. We're getting closer to the formal introduction, but beta, which I've shown you on a number of occasions just to get you used to it. Now, strangely, interestingly enough, beta, the actual formula, which you won't have to do very much at all, but the actual formula for beta involves the standard deviation. And then, oddly enough, the one that's used in the practical world, the interest rates, they are calculated formally in finance from beta. So standard deviation goes to beta, goes to interest rates. So all of these metrics of risk are actually interrelated in the work that we do at the professional level. Now, a little bit over here, other metrics of risk. One that I had shown you, and these are more informal, down to the point where they are very informal. Price earnings ratio. There is no holy grail number on it. It's just a big or a small to tell you something about risk. That's all it is. It's just one of those that I want you to be formal. We have to be in our business lives. That's why I bitch about at you about writing well, being in class, and all that kind of crap, is because we have to be formal. So when I say be loose, P/E ratio is kind of like you have a feel for what's big and small. That's a little bit not very cool, but we have to do this. And now the next one, and I hate writing this in a class like this, but there's another one that is basically gut. This comes from fundamental analysis, and I'm going to put that here in parentheses, fundamental analysis. Now, when I say fundamental analysis, I am talking about getting off your butt and going to the companies, calling, probing, getting gossip, thinking with your head and with something a little bit lower than your head, like in your stomach somewhere. Look, when I walk into a big box retailer and I see shelves that don't have stuff on them, that worries me. I want to know, why are you out of stock on all of this stuff? Now, one or two, yeah, but when I see five or six or 10 or 20, then I've got a problem. Okay, now I used to go into this store and there was always an employee there, there were cash registers open. Now I stand in lines longer. Now I can't find anyone who can help me do something. Or on the other side, I have people charging at me. Can I help you find something? Yeah, you can help me find someone who will shut up while I look. You know, that's me. And then my daughter says, Dad, shut up. Stop that. You're being mean. That's right. And you're ugly. I ask questions. Why are there fewer employees? Are you trying to save money by getting rid of people? Did the Wall Street boys tell you that they would buy your stock if you fired 5,000 people? Well, are you that hard up for a higher stock price that you're going to wreck your base of knowledge in your company by firing people? I ask those questions. Why are you having those people attack the customers? Are you that hard up for sales? Doesn't your product sell itself? Or can you actually back off your customers and let them think for themselves before you go on the attack with them? Just be somewhere in the area so they can ask you a question. You look at these things. You start asking yourself these kinds of fundamental questions. Okay, this company has had 3 CEOs in the last 7 years. Why is that happening? Is there something in this company that is a problem that they get rid of? Or are they picking CEOs, and if they can't suddenly make magic happen, you get rid of them? You don't have patience as a company if that's what's going on. What's the morale of the people in your company? Look on the message boards. Find out what these people say behind the company management's back. Look on Twitter for signs of discontent, things like that. So, in other words, fundamental analysis has to do with your gut, and it also has to do with thinking about what you're seeing and what it could possibly mean, okay? Madam, you know that I run a ghost hunting club, right? Did you know that? Okay. So, when we were in this basement down in downtown Bloomington, there was this white mist forming along the side where all these people were standing asking questions of a ghost. Now, they weren't hearing anything, but there's this white mist forming. Now, that could mean to me, okay, there's probably some fog in this basement and all that. But it could also mean that there's a soul-eating demon down there. So which do you suppose I should be more concerned about as far as my faculty responsibilities are concerned? I should assume which? Soul-eating demon, absolutely. See, that even scared you so much you dropped your pen. You see, that's the whole point, is assume the worst, always. When you're in business, think not about good things, about candy and My Little Pony and all those creepy things like that. Think about what is the dark side of it. Okay. Now, I'm going to take you on another journey here for just a moment. You'll bear with me here. Okay. I'm going to turn this on here in a moment. Okay. I want you to imagine for a moment. You, sir. No. I got another one for you. You, sir, have decided that you want to be a bodybuilder. You want to have big, big muscles. You want to have muscles that are so big you can change your name to Rolf and develop a Swedish accent so you can say, my name is Rolf, ripple, 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 with your pectoral muscles, okay? Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. 5 days away, easily, that's all. You, sir, have decided that you want to be a god of good looks. I mean, just incredible. You want to be a 10, okay? You want women to really care about you. You want to be a genius. You want to be one of those creepy, weird-ass people on Big Bang Theory. You know, in reality, those are the most annoying people in the world. They deserve a swirly, and we give it to them as much as we can. Okay. And you, sir, want to be the fastest runner on earth. You want to be the Flash. Zoom, zoom. You want to measure your speed in warp. Okay. Well, you get down to the business of trying to do this. You know, you start that first morning. You're struggling, gasping, but it begins to come together. And one day you hear, do you ever see the movie Rocky, the original? And you grab that, you put 5 raw eggs into a glass, you like that. Let me tell you, it's bad. I tried it. I was so inspired as a little fat boy to do that. And I swallowed it. I got it in my throat and I thought, nope, I can't get rid of it. And it went down, and 5 seconds later, debris field. Okay? Literally, seriously. I mean, it was just like, oh. I sounded like Rocky. Adrian! Okay. Okay, anyway. You build your muscles up, and you measure them every day. 7 inches. 8 inches. 8.2, 8.2.25, 8.26, 8.2. Something's wrong. You start using skinny mullions to look better. You grow your hair out and you turn it blonde. And then you start posting your picture on rateme.com. And you find out that you went from a 4 to a 5 to a 6 to a 6.7, 6.75, 6.76. 6.76. So you try a couple of other things. You put in contact lenses that make your eyes blue, and that gets you up to a 7.1, 7.15. You buy a big heavy hammer and you hold it like this. Doesn't do a thing. You start studying. Every day, you get rid of that idiotic internet and you actually start reading those weird old things called books. And you open up ancient texts and you see all this knowledge flowing at you. And your IQ goes from 120 to 123 to 124 to 125. But there's a problem. You just can't get beyond that. You start asking, Mom, where were you born? And she says, Decatur. Oh, God. You're running faster every day. And finally, you feel so butch, you get in front of a train. And you start running in front of it. And all of a sudden, you see, the problem is that what you're seeing is a phenomenon all through nature. It's not just people. It's physical things from galaxies to stars to animals to chemical processes. It's the physics of performance envelopes. There's only so much you can achieve. A star can produce only so much heat and light given its fuel load of hydrogen. A car can produce only so many horsepower given the technology and materials of its engine design. A person can achieve only so much beef given his beef factor, which is partly genetic, partly physical, but you tried even using steroids and all you did was end up what happened to Bruce Jenner. Okay? I know, right? Woman of the year? She wasn't a woman the whole year. For God's sake, what do they mean? Too soon? Okay. Where the hell was I? Oh, okay. Well, okay. Here's the thing, is that you can do only so much. But in order to be the best, you have to do as much as you can. Even though it won't take you to the infinite limits, it will take you so far. Now, let me show you how that plays out in practice in a couple of venues. I'm trying to think of it. Who I should do this on. Ah. You, good lady. I'm going to tell you about your life. From birth to death. We'll start with her. You were born healthy. You were decent size. 7 pounds, 12 ounces. Oops, I don't know. Let me do this a little harder. And so your medical costs at your early age, they were fairly low. You had your usual childhood stuff, but nothing big. And you didn't get sick that much. You had a couple of colicky episodes, and there were some problems you had in your early childhood. And then you started learning how to ride a trike, and you ran into that semi-truck, so that was kind of big. And then there was that demon possession. And then at the age of 8, you were getting a little fussy about things, and you broke an arm. But it wasn't anything. And then you had a couple of good years, and then you found out about something called boys. And your acne started acting up. And then you got through your teen years, and you had a couple of bad things happen there. But interestingly enough, most people in their 20s, they begin to get herd immunity. Do you remember being sick when you were a kid and how you aren't as sick as often? It's more not so much so now, but back in the day, you were, I mean, we all had snot noses, impetigo, and things like that. But you get into your 20s and you start developing herd immunities and you start not being sick as often. When you are sick, it's probably, you feel like it's the end of the world, but not too bad. And for you, you're healthy in your 20s, into your 30s. You have your first cancer scare in your early 40s. And that's very expensive, and then you get past that. And you have a few problems. You get some illnesses, kidney problems. But progressively, you are getting a little sicker as time goes on. Then you have a surgery or two. Then in your late 60s, you have enough money that you can hire a cougar bait boy. And you get into your 80s and your 90s, and then you die. Okay, now, gotta find a guy. Oh, yeah. You, sir. You were a sickly little baby. I mean, you barfed a lot. Bad diapers. You were always feeling sick. But you got a little healthier, and there were a few ups and downs. And then, you know, about 11 years old, you started getting problems, and then you did a little bit of things. You cut yourself sometimes just for fun, and you found out about something this guy in a garage was making that got you in a lot of trouble. But then you started getting healthier in your 20s and 30s. And then
You started having problems with your heart. You got through one heart attack, and then you started having to take Viagra. And then you got diabetes. And then you die. Now, you notice that there's something going on here. If I start compositing, I notice that they don't have a perfect correlation of their good times or their bad times. You just won't. And if I put more and more people in, they will partially cancel out each other's health care costs, to the point where when I get into the thousands, the tens of thousands, the hundreds of thousands of people, these individual lines all go away, and you have a smooth, constant cost per year of the group as a whole. This is the basis of insurance. It's also, as I put in people, younger people in here with lower costs, that corrects for the people out here who are in their older years with a higher cost. And also, if I put in people of different of the different sexes, different ethnicities, different races, different lifestyles, different regions, all of those add to the cancellation effect. Diversity is not a bad thing. It is the best thing that can happen. The less correlation we have among the people in the insured group, the more rapidly all of the quirks smooth themselves out so that you have a predictable, we know every year how much it's going to cost to insure this population. In some years, when you're having a bad year, you're having a good year, you're having a middling year, you have a terrible year. And then, sorry. But you see, that is the whole idea of adding to the portfolio. Is that you are actually, as long as you don't have perfect correlation, you are lowering the risk of the entire portfolio. What that means in stocks, in securities, is that if I were to measure risk by standard deviation or some measure like that on the vertical axis against the number of different stocks in the portfolio, with one stock, there's going to be an extraordinary amount of volatility, risk, uncertainty. Uncertainty about the world, about the U.S. economy, about that industry, about that company in that period of time. But put in another stock that could have the same risk level, the same return expected. You put those two together, and the risk of the portfolio is actually lower as long as the stocks are not perfectly correlated. They cancel out a little bit of each other's peculiar risk. You see, when I was talking about those risks of you having diabetes or having a heart attack, you having kidney failure, those are individual risks to you and to some extent to your ethnic group. Get people in there who are not in your age group, your sex, your region, your ethnicity, and you get cancellation effect. It works the same way with populations for insurance as it does with stocks. I put three stocks in. They all have exactly the same individual risk. They're all very risky stocks, but they start to cancel out some of each other's risk. And on, what will happen is that the risk will decline
hyperbolically. That term that you saw in your math classes, the hyperbola, it actually is a real thing. This risk of the portfolio approaches a lower bound asymptotically. As you add stocks to the portfolio, you eventually start, you're approaching what we call the market risk, the risk that cannot be removed, what we call the systematic risk. The systematic risk is the risk that is embedded in the system. The risk that is embedded in the system that cannot be removed. This is a risk that you play to. This is a risk for which you can expect a reward. This amount of risk up here, this unsystematic risk, can be removed. You're not going to get a reward for that. You should not expect a reward because you can get rid of that risk. It is not part of the system. So please give me a reward market for bearing risk that is just my own stupid choices. Have you ever heard of the Darwin Awards? The Darwin Awards are given every year to the people who have given humanity the greatest gift by getting themselves killed because they're stupid. They're voluntarily taking their stupid genes out of the human genome. Okay? Now, the Darwin Awards are given every year to people who deserve to die because they are way too stupid to be alive. For risks that they did not need to take, that they took anyway. And because they're dead, we can give them a reward because they won't get it with a Darwin trophy given to their next of kin. Let me give you an example of a Darwin Award. This has been some years back. We have a group of young men, risk factor one, who are in West Virginia, risk factor two, who find an abandoned mine, risk factor three, in which there is a box of blasting caps, risk factor four. They go back to their trailer park, risk factor five, with a case of beer, risk factor six, and they put those blasting caps in a gigantic aquarium, risk factor, keep going, and they get themselves crap-faced drunk, risk factor, and they start trying to apply electricity to the blasting caps, and it doesn't work. So now we get down to the nitty-gritty. One of the young men, drunk off his butt, grabs one of the blasting caps and he says, now get this is an important risk factor. He says, watch this. And he puts the blasting cap in his mouth and he chomps down on it. Now, he didn't win the Darwin Award because he actually lived through it. He lost all of his teeth, which actually made him more breeding stock in West Virginia. But you understand, he wanted to be paid by the insurance, his health insurance company, for all of the reconstructive surgery on his face, which basically looked very, very kind of hangy, like something out of a Simpsons old man character. They wouldn't pay it. You see, because he was stupid, he did something that was totally and completely ignorant. He didn't have to do it. And so we don't reward people for doing that kind of stuff unless they're in the movie Jackass. And in stocks, you don't get rewarded for bearing risk that you can get rid of. So if you think you're a genius because you have bought one stock or two stocks, it means nothing. And on these financial news networks where they show these stocks with high volatility, well, this is a very risky stock. You don't have any idea what the risk of it is because that risk you're seeing in the price volatility doesn't mean anything. What does this stock look like in a normal portfolio? Now, here's what I'm going to show you. This has to do with correlation. The lower the correlation between two things, the more they will cancel out each other's risk. So in other words, what I was talking when I was telling you the story of these two people in their lives, They obviously had some correlations, but they also had times when they weren't correlated. So there was a lower correlation between them. Now, what I'm going to do here, hoping I can find it. I want to find a place called Portfolio Visualizer. And I'm not entirely sure of the URL, so I'll look it up. Do you see Portfolio Visualizer? It is? Good thing you said that. I was going. Okay, now, what Portfolio Visualizer does is it actually, you can give it stock ticker symbols and tell it how far back to look to do its correlations, and it will give you correlation coefficients. So you can build a portfolio with the knowledge that the things in it are going to quickly cancel out each other's noise. Now, what this means is with correlation coefficients, a very high correlation would be like 0.5, 0.6, anything above that is ridiculous. Low correlations are below 0.3, 0.2. So what you want to do if you're designing a portfolio of your own is to look for stocks that have low correlations because they will more quickly drop that line down to its envelope, down to its performance envelope. You see, that's a performance. It's just like all the other ones I was talking about. So putting a few in here just to get an idea. I'll put in Target and Walmart. What else should I put in here? Any suggestions? I don't know. Let's try Bank of America. No, let's do Citigroup. C, okay. A couple more in here. I'm kind of drawing a blank right now. What could go in here? Kroger? KR, consumer, something industrial. What would be an industrial company? What would? Cat. Oh, good. Cat. And then one more. Who else should? I'm trying to think. Did financial services, did industrial, did retail. What? What is it? Like what? Oh, like Exxon? Oh, duh. Yeah. What is Zom? Yeah, I should have known that. As in zombies. Zom. Okay. Now, the start date, well, let's just go back to the beginning of the year. And then the end date. That I don't have to do that. Daily returns, let's do 90 days just to get a lot. Actually, maybe 120 days. And now you're going to see the correlation matrix. Okay, notice Target against Walmart. High correlation. Do you see it? And that's sort of logical. You say, well, Target and Walmart, they're not the same. Well, in terms of what they do, they are the same. And so you would not want those in a portfolio together because they would not do very much to low. Well, they would. They'd do some. But you could make the risk of the portfolio drop faster with other choices. So now, Cat against Walmart. They're actually going opposite directions. They would be highly uncorrelated. They definitely would work together. And a lot of these are the same way. You've got Target against anything but Walmart would be fine, and the same Walmart against anything else would be fine. Citigroup against Caterpillar, that's a little too much for my blood. They seem, because of it's mostly because of just the scale of their operations. They're both very large companies. And they both, interestingly enough, have some dependence upon the United States government. CAT for a lot of contracts, although they do a lot of other work too. Citigroup, because pretty much all of those big banks are nothing but pure welfare queens. They would be dead if the U.S. government weren't propping them up with lots of money. But Exxon against, what was C? What? Citigroup. Exxon against Citigroup, again, large, both of them massive companies. And so they are, that's something too that you notice is going on with this, is that at a certain scale, these companies all begin to behave more like each other because they are all behaving more like quasi-governments. When you get to the size where you see market caps of $100 billion or $200, $500 billion, those are basically small countries. And so their behaviors are more like each other than they are like businesses, which can be quite different from each other. Okay? Yeah, anything? Go ahead.
Isn't this basically just like hedge funding, like trying to find opposites?
Yeah, but this is, the hedge funds, you do it much more mathematically. You're right, absolutely. And I would start with this, absolutely. But when you're building a portfolio, when I'm telling people you can do your own stuff with building a portfolio, it's more like the basic rules. Just look for stocks that aren't very well correlated with each other. And also, being negatively correlated is not a good thing in a portfolio because you can actually work at odds to each other in a portfolio. And you can also stumble into stocks that are not very desirable. Okay, here's one of the things that I could warn you about right off the bat, and I think I already mentioned this. Maybe I didn't. You can get stocks that have negative betas, which basically means that they have negative correlations against each other, against other stocks, against the bulk of stocks. They have negative correlations. If they have negative betas, they probably have negative correlation coefficients against most stocks. We call those stocks contrarians because they will go in the opposite direction of a market. And those are for people who are, you remember I told you about bulls and bears? You know, the whole thing about bulls and bears. Well, a contrarian is a bear on crack, okay? It's a bear that you wake it up and it does, it's a bear that starts doing really bad, bad things to you. You know, like, I don't even want to describe it. It's just, those are the stocks that have negative betas. Are most, one of the most common things you'll see with negative beta stocks are, and they're slightly negative, you don't see huge negatives, are gold mining stocks will have negative betas sometimes. And it's just because gold is one of those things that would be highly desirable if the rest of the world went to hell, kind of thing. So when I see a negative correlation, I really don't want to do that too much with stocks. Just avoid it when you can. Now, I wanted to bring in real quick here. Let me bring in to the analysis an entertainment company like Netflix, NFLX. Now, look at that one. The reason I'm bringing that one up is that's that thing where there's no reason why there's no logic in that. See that correlation coefficient, Caterpillar against Netflix? You ask yourself, what the hell is that? Why? And this is one of the things where it's just statistics. It happened. It might not persist, but for right now, I would not put Caterpillar and Netflix into a portfolio together. But look at Netflix against the rest of these stocks. Okay? What that tells me is that Netflix would be good. You put Netflix or Caterpillar, but you don't put them both into a portfolio. And this is just how you, as an average person with a college education, being taught by the best professor who ever walked the earth, can do your own portfolio management if you choose to. It's basic rules. Find your beta, put stocks in it that have the betas that you like around the same around a certain beta. Go to this correlation coefficient thing to make sure those stocks aren't highly correlated so that they'll reduce your risk. Now, the last thing is, how many stocks do you need to really diversify out to shake out most of that diversifiable, unsystematic risk? Well, you're not going to get rid of all of it unless you buy a ginormous market portfolio of every stock in the world, in its proportion to its contribution to the world economy. If you're not going to do that, you're not going to get rid of all of the unsystematic risk. But you can get rid of about 95% of it if you craft low correlation stocks and put 30 of them together. Just start building your portfolio while you're young. It'll be highly unbalanced because you won't be able to afford round lots right away. But as you can afford round lots, don't just keep fueling the same stocks. Go after other stocks to build the portfolio's diversification. And then once you've got the fully diversified portfolio, then you go to the next thing, which is called skimming. In a portfolio of stocks, you look at all of your stocks. You have five stocks that you're always looking at any given time. You always get rid of the lowest performing one, two, or three stocks in your portfolio and put in something new to refresh the portfolio with something new at all times. As long as it follows your rules of beta and correlation, always skim off the low performers and put in something new. Don't be sentimental, and don't always listen to idiots on television or idiots in the classroom. Use the rules of risk that I've taught you, and don't forget about gut. Start opening your eyes and looking at the world around you. Now, as I said, you're going to have a quiz pop up tonight. It'll be a screen that you'll answer the questions off the graphic that'll be included with the quiz. You have until Wednesday. Don't start bitching at me if it's not up at 8 o'clock on the button. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.